Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
The singular feature of the Great Crash of 1929 was that the worst continued to worsen. What looked one day like the end proved on the next day to have been only the beginning. Nothing could have been more ingeniously designed to maximize the suffering and also to ensure that as few as possible escaped the common misfortune. The fortunate speculator who had funds to answer the first margin call presently got another and equally urgent one, and if he met that, there would be still another. In the end, all the money he had was extracted from him and lost. The man with the smart money, who was safely out of the market when the first crash came, naturally went back in to pick up bargains. Not only were a recorded 12,894,650 shares sold on the 24th of October, precisely that same number were bought. The bargains then suffered a ruinous fall. Even the man who waited out all of October and all of November, who saw the volume of trading return to normal and saw Wall Street become as placid as a produce market, and who then bought common stocks, would see their value drop to a third or a quarter of the purchase price in the next 24 months. The Coolidge bull market had been a remarkable phenomenon. The ruthlessness of its liquidation was, in its own way, equally remarkable. Well, those are some extracts from The Great Crash of 1929 by John Kenneth Galbraith, first published in 1955, and that came from page 130. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon. This is Richard Martin here from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. And as always, I encourage you to call in with your questions, your comments, your rants, whatever you wish to share with your fellow listeners. And to do so, please avail yourself of the toll-free number at 888-873-4643. Once more, 888-873-4643. The engineer just stepped away for a few moments, but give him 5 minutes and I'm sure he'll be back. Right, if you would like to send in your questions by email, then the email address is rmartin@gscorporation.com. I'm going to repeat that, and please remember that the word corporation needs to be written out in full. And that the GS stand for Global Strategic, which is Global Strategic Investments here in Miami, where I work. Once more, the email address, rmartin@gscorporation.com. All right. Finally, if you would like to call me privately with your personal affairs, then you may do that by calling me on my direct line at the following number, 305 305-357-5575. Once more, 305-357-5575. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have obviously some very major news to talk about today concerning Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were, to all intents and purposes, taken over by the government in the form of Henry Paulson, Secretary of the Treasury, over the weekend. Of course, you and I have taken over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac because we are now responsible for the shortfall in payments that they may have. We will guarantee that these two sick companies do not indeed go under, and we will fail to do so. But in the meantime, we will have coughed up several hundred billion dollars, and what will be interesting to see is how the next administration will deal with this problem, which will already have gone way down the line in terms of money which has already been wasted away saving these two spastic enterprises. You know, despite decades of free market rhetoric from Republican and Democratic lawmakers, Washington has a long history of providing financial help to the private sector when the economic or political risk of a corporate collapse appeared too high. The effort to save Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is only the latest in a series of financial maneuvers by the government that stretch back to the rescue of the military contractor Lockheed Aircraft at the Penn Central Railroad under President Richard Nixon, the shoring up of Chrysler in the waning days of the Carter administration, and, of course, the salvage of the U.S. savings and loan system in the late 80s. More recently, after airplanes were grounded because of the terrorist attacks of September the 11th, 2001, Congress approved $15 billion in subsidies and loan guarantees to the faltering airlines. Now, with the U.S. government preparing to save Fannie and Freddie only 6 months after the Federal Reserve Board orchestrated the rescue of Bear Stearns, it appears that the mortgage crisis has forced the government once again to shove ideology aside and get into the bailout business. And I quote from Robert Brudner, dean of the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia. If anybody thought we had a pure free market financial system, they should think again. End of quote. Well, today in Business with Reuters, U.S. takes control of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Asian central banks among winners in Fannie and Freddie shift. A tangled web with many raveled threads. The closest historical analogy to the Fannie-Freddie crisis is the rescue of the farm credit and savings loan systems in the late 80s, said Bert Eli, a banking consultant who has been a long-time critic of the mortgage finance companies. The savings and loan bailout followed years of high interest rates and risky lending practices and ultimately cost taxpayers roughly $124 billion, with the banking industry kicking in another $30 billion, according to Eli. Even if the rescue of Fannie and Freddie ends up costing tens of billions of dollars, the savings and loan collapse will still remain the costliest government bailout to date, said Lawrence White, a professor of economics at the Stern School of Business at New York University. And I quote, the S&L debacle cost upwards of $100 billion, and the economy is more than twice the size today that it was in the late 1980s. I don't think this will turn out to be as serious as that when over 2,000 banks and thrifts failed between the 1980s and the mid-1990s, end of quote. Well, most of those losses were caused by the shortfall between what the government paid depositors and what it received by selling the troubled real estate portfolios it acquired after taking over the failed thrifts. In the Chrysler case, Carter and lawmakers in states with auto plants helped push through a package of $1.5 billion in loan guarantees for the troubled car maker, while also demanding concessions from labor unions and lenders. While Chrysler is remembered as a major bailout, White says it was minor compared with the savings and loan crisis or the current effort to shore up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The government did not have to give money directly to Chrysler, and it actually earned a profit on the deal because of stock warrants it received when the loan guarantees were provided. At the time, Chrysler had a workforce of more than 100,000 people. Still, Eli makes a distinction between the rescue of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the thrifts versus the aid packages for Chrysler and other industrial companies. Quote, they didn't have a federal nexus. They weren't creatures of the federal government. End of quote. This effort is also different from the others because of the potential fallout for the broader economy and especially the beleaguered housing sector if it does not succeed. Unlike a particular auto company or even a major bank like Continental Illinois National Bank and Trust, which was bailed out in 1984, quote, we depend on Fannie and Freddie for funding almost half of our mortgage market. And that comes from Thomas Stanton, an expert on the two companies who also teaches at Johns Hopkins University. Quote, the government has many less degrees of freedom in dealing with these companies than in the earlier bailouts. Well, when you thought that was bad enough, some of you may have listened to the interview this morning with Warren Buffett and his little chickadee-bicky quirk. Warren started off saying very clearly, he said, the Fed did exactly the right thing. He then went on to say he wouldn't change anything in the plan. Well, isn't that sad? How truly sad for a formerly great man to cave in to this nonsense. Here's a guy that doesn't even know what the full plan is yet, but he says he wouldn't change anything and that the plan is, quote, exactly right. Of course, he didn't mention his motives for lending support to Paulson, like a huge portion of his net worth in Wells Fargo or the fact that much of his wealth depends on the Paulson charade being carried on for as long as possible. So guys like Warren Buffett can back out of a lot of positions they're in. Well, it gets worse. Buffett admitted he spoke with Paulson on Sunday. Why? Why in the world would Paulson call Buffett, other than to enlist Buffett's support for Paulson's scheme, or maybe call in a favor or two? Listen to the Buffett interview this morning. It makes no sense, and he doesn't sound as clear with thought as he has in the past. It was actually the first time that I heard Warren Buffett interviewed when he didn't seem to be making sense at all. And that, of course, is very sad. This morning, Paulson, and by the way, that's the guy to whom we have all handed over our hard-earned tax money, he was asked, what is the cost to the taxpayers? His answer didn't faze me in the least. I'm already brain dead to this entire fiasco. His answer should scare you and everyone in Washington. He said, quote, we obviously don't know that yet, end of quote. And he sort of seemed to want to add, and you shouldn't care what it'll cost, because it's all mine, and what it'll cost you is meaningless, because you're all meaningless, and we'll do what we want with your money and your lives. And that's kind of really what he wanted to say. But then he went on, by the way, grinning incomprehensibly. He said, and I quote, it depends on how long it will take for housing to come back, end of quote. Is he kidding? No. He isn't kidding. That's his ace in the hole. He can blame it all on housing when this all caves in on the taxpayer. He will point his fingers at housing and hold up his hands, claiming he warned everyone. And, by the way, he is still the fiscal boss of the United States. So taxpayers will do whatever he says, whenever he says, and they will enjoy it or they will be silenced. Not funny, huh? You know, he lowered the moat and invited all of his pals in. He basically delayed addressing these problems for 2 years. Instead of a receivership and a wipeout, Paulson opted for what they call a conservatorship, which is just a nice way of saying basic nationalization and a wipeout. Paulson opted for nationalization and giveaway. He brought in two of the boys from the financial industry that have facilitated the financial crisis, instead of going to the corporate world to find two honest men with clean hands. He left the doors open for 2 years. He didn't use the bazooka. He used the squirt gun, and he filled it with Kool-Aid. Instead of pointing the bazooka at the guys that created the mess, he has dumped the fix on the taxpayers with a blank check. Bill Gross has been bragging about how much money he is going to make on this at the expense of the taxpayers. And of course, he has a blank check to write whatever he wants moving forward. You know, this is the worst part about all this. If Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are going to mark their losses to market, why don't the financial institutions have to do the same? Why don't the community and regional banks? The end result is ugly for short-term traders with short positions and puts on the financials. The markets rallied this morning as Paulson has lowered the gates to the moat. The financial institutions will run up the stocks here just as they have in Asia and Europe. The markets were up 3 to 5% earlier on, so look for a huge rally and the wipeouts for many of the shorts. You know, I'd like to believe that the system would come to its senses and realize that the housing problem is not fixed. In fact, it is getting worse, and nothing Paulson has done will have stabilized this market. Mortgages will continue to go toxic, and commercial loans will be the next thing Paulson will need to bail out, followed by the FDIC, FHA, and student loan programs. You know, the smart move this weekend would have been to wipe out the common and preferred shares and then put a receivership in place, not a conservatorship or conservatorship or however you want to pronounce it. I don't even know what that word means. I've never heard it before. Well, make no mistake, as the cliche goes, ladies and gentlemen, we are one step closer to the Great Depression, or even two steps. Paulson pulled this thing off, and Washington let him do it. Essentially, Washington has just turned over the United States to a band of brothers, and they're not the brothers we need. This band of brothers, ladies and gentlemen, is a band of thieves. All right. Once again, the number for you to call in is 888-873-4643. I'll give it to you again. 888-873-4643. Please feel free, call in anytime, discuss this situation, talk about your own issues, ask questions, make comments. I'm here for you. All right, in the meantime, let's deal with a couple of pieces of email that came through. One of them was from a Mr. Hamilton, who says, "Hi, Mr. Martin. I have always loved to hear you on Gary's program. I so respected your perspective and your insight. My question is, I'm currently in a tough place financially. Can I use my term life insurance policy as collateral to secure a short-term loan? Is this possible? I have a $100,000 policy, and I'm looking for around $30,000. Thanks for your response in advance, Mr. Hamilton." Well, Mr. Hamilton, it pains me to have to say this, but you can usually borrow from the insurance company using the cash value in your life insurance as collateral. Now, pains me because I don't think you should be doing this. If you really are in as tough a place as you say you are, you should be getting rid of what it is you can to eliminate that $30,000, whatever it takes, however many of the things it takes. This is money that you have put aside to ensure your family against your demise. This is not money that should be used for this purpose. Absolutely not. People depend on you, Mr. Hamilton. Don't do this. Find another way. Get that $30,000. If it's a mortgage and you are sitting on negative equity here, you may want to walk away from it. I don't know, as always, I don't know enough about your situation, so I really can't address it properly. But the reason that I gave you that answer is because I feel very strongly that what you're doing is probably ill-advised. And you're welcome to call me and discuss it with me, I'll be almost only too happy to discuss it. But in the meantime, think very carefully and reflect on what you want to do here. All right. Well, let's deal with Mr. Kruger's rent. Came in the middle of yesterday afternoon. I feel that Steve must have had a case of the Sunday afternoon inspiration. Anyway, here we go. This is Steve Kruger's bi-weekly rant. Off we go. Richard, slavery in a free market economy is not a profitable endeavor, as it requires almost as many guards as slaves. In the Civil War, we redid our tariffs and freed our slaves. Today, our slaves have no chains or keepers, as they are our illegal alien population. I may have pointed this out in the past. Sorry for the rehash. As for debtors in the 17th and 18th century, we fled Europe to avoid debtors' prison. Some of the prisons were so full of debtors, they were released and sent to the New World. Today, we have again outdone ourselves with our new bankruptcy laws. It seems you can go broke today and all your debts will reset to zero except for your credit card debt. In the past, credit card debt was wiped out in bankruptcy. This gave the debtor a chance to start anew and re-establish his credit over time. In our credit-based society, we must borrow more this year than last year. This allows us to keep the illusion of an expanding economy alive. With the new bankruptcy laws, we have established or re-established a form of debtor's prison without walls. It is almost a guarantee that these people will never get out of debt, let alone re-establish their credit. Richard, if you step back and look at all the financial missteps that have taken place from, say, the S&L crisis till today, I get the idea that the sheer volume of money in the system creates the feeding ground for more and more creative crime. In 1950, a truck driver's pay was around $45 a week, and his wife didn't have to work if she didn't want to. Not much money in the system yet, and not any crazy schemes to leverage risk yet. But as the money supply goes up, so does money-related crime. Thanks for the wake-up call, Steve Kruger. Just one little detail here, Steve. The business about freeing the slaves. You do understand, don't you, that civil war of yours was absolutely unnecessary and uncalled for. In other parts of the world, in fact, in every other part of the world, without exception, governments bought the slaves and freed them and made slavery subsequently illegal. There was absolutely no reason why the United States should not have done the same. There was a different reason for your civil war, Steve, as I am sure you are aware, and I will not go into it here, but it doesn't have much to do with slavery. Okay, thank you very much for your rant, and I appreciate it immensely. We shall continue on apace. Once more, the call-in number, 888-873-4643. Again, 888-873-4643. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about mortgage defaults. I had mentioned to you that although the subprime mortgages initiated this sickening downturn in the mortgage and real estate markets, and it was, of course, described as being self-contained and that there would be no fallout in any other branch of the mortgage arena or anywhere else for that matter, I said right along, always from the beginning, that that was not correct, that one thing would indeed lead to another, and that Alt-A mortgages would then become contaminated, and finally the prime mortgages would start to default at disturbingly high rates, which is in fact a development that has, as of now, threatened to slow any potential housing recovery in addition to everything else we've talked about. You know that the delinquency rate for prime mortgages worth less than $417,000 was 2.44% in May, compared with a 1.38% rate a year earlier. And that comes from Loan Performance, which is a unit of First American, CoreLogic that compiles and analyzes residential mortgage statistics. Delinquencies jumped even more for prime loans of more than 417,000, so-called jumbo loans. They rose to 4.03% of outstanding loans in May, compared with 1.11% a year earlier. Prime loans issued in 2007 are the worst performing of all, falling at a rate of nearly triple that of prime loans issued in 2006, and that's according to Loan Performance. Now, I quote from Pat Newport, a real estate economist with Global Insight, which is a forecasting firm, who says, "The extent of how bad these loans are is doing is very troubling." Washington Mutual CEO Kerry Killinger said last month that the bank's prime loan delinquencies are on the rise. As of June the 30th, 2.19% of prime loans issued by WAMU in 2007 were already delinquent, compared with 1.40% of loans of the prime quality issued in 2005. Well, as I said, prime loans are just the latest class of mortgages to suffer a spike in failure rates. The first block to go bad was, of course, subprime mortgages, whose problem set the housing meltdown in motion. Then we had the alt-A loans. Now, as the prime loans are added to the mix, the resulting foreclosures could haunt the housing market for a long time. And that comes from Global Insight's Patrick Newport, who says, "Home prices will drop for quite a while, maybe several years." End of quote. Well, you probably know that prices are already off nearly 20% from their 2006 highs, and that comes from S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index. And there's a strong inverse correlation between home prices and defaults, according to Lawrence Yun, who, as you know, is our new genius chief economist for the National Association of Realtors. "It's a feedback loop," he said. "Price declines lead to more defaults, which lead to more price declines." Well, welcome to the daylight, Lawrence. More foreclosures will add to an already massive oversupply of homes on the market. Inventories are up to about 11 months' worth of sales at the current rate. The failure of prime mortgages will also make it more difficult for borrowers to find affordable loans, and that will slow sales even more. Lending standards have been tightening for months, but if prime loans start to look risky, lenders will be even more conservative about who gets a mortgage. So you see, there are no free lunches here. There's no easy way out of this. If anybody was to decide to question Henry Paulson and what he thinks he's doing, bailing out these ridiculous mortgage companies who thought they were hedge companies a couple of years back, nobody knows how much there is out there in terms of losing derivative bets that these companies have made. They were already rife with corruption before anybody even started to look at them. This is, do not misunderstand this, ladies and gentlemen, this is an open-ended book, an open check on these two companies. Nobody has a clue how much is at risk here, except that I can tell you that it will be a lot more than $200 billion. This is grotesquely serious, and you don't know how to deal with it, I don't know how to deal with it, and I assure you, nobody else knows how to deal with it. Nobody has a clue. Ladies and gentlemen, do not be misled or blindsided by anybody with a fancy degree who tells you this is how the problem is going to be solved. I absolutely assure you, nobody has a clue how to solve this, because there is no solution. And I've said this again and again, and it's not something people want to hear. And if people start talking like this on CNBC, the only result will be that they don't get invited back to do so again. So they don't. You know, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what happened in the mid-90s. because that was really when things took off, never to look back no more, as it were. What happened, basically, at that point was, well, first of all, very few people realized that in the early to mid-90s there was a core change in the functioning of the Fed and the dollar zone economy, and this precipitated a massive rise in the money supply known as M3 and the various associated asset bubbles. Well, this core change was amplified by a couple of other simultaneous trends, which I will also talk about, and this caused a number of secondary ills. But first, let me explain the central piece of the puzzle, and I need to talk a little bit about fractional reserve banking, which, as a matter of fact, I described in some detail on my very first show on Progressive Radio Network some three-odd years ago. Let's just look at fractional reserve banking. It's very important to understand this. The fractional reserve central banking system is the banking system which is in use in the U.S. The concept is that banks are required to keep a fraction of their assets on hand, deposited safely at the Fed, to act as a cash cushion at times when depositors demand their money from the bank as cash. This cash reserve is in proportion to the amount of depositors' money that is actually loaned out. The proportion of this cash reserve to the total amount loaned out is intended to provide just enough of a buffer to keep the bank solvent and keep things running smoothly in the event a lot of depositors make demands for cash at once, such as during a run on a bank. This fraction, called the reserve fraction or ratio, is typically from 5% to 20% of the amount of money the bank has loaned out. This may seem low, but holding any more cash in reserve than is needed, except for outlier cases, is considered an uneconomical use of capital by a bank. The cash in reserve is not making money for either the bank or its depositors as loan, so from a day-to-day operations perspective, the less reserves, the better. From a longer-term risk management perspective, the more, the better. Statistically, 5 to 20% reserves is the so-called right amount, except in those outlier cases where these levels are either too high because reserves at those levels are sometimes constraining the economy's access to credit, or, conversely, too low at other times because too many depositors are making a rush to liquidity and demanding their cash. The reserve fraction, considered as a number that is mutable as a matter of policy, is also one of the most powerful tools a central bank can use to adjust the amount of money available to the economy. It's easy to see why. A reserve requirement of 10% means that banks can lend out 10 times the actual money on deposit with the Fed. Even a seemingly small change from, say, 2% to 8% means that 12.5 times the money on deposit can be lent out. For example, $10 billion initially on deposit with 10% reserve requirement results in approximately $100 billion of money available as loans. If the reserve fraction is reduced from 10 to 8%, then for the same $10 billion cash on deposit, there can be approximately $125 billion of money available as loans in the economy. This is an increase in the money supply of around 25% from a reduction of the reserve ratio by 2%. Now, this is very important to understand, for reasons which will become clear in a moment. The objective is to show that what happened starting around 1995 is much worse than even the most blistering theoretical critique predicted. It is a veritable nightmare scenario that we all will have to cope with for years and years to come. The key event that happened around 1995 is that the fractional reserve ratio was not only lowered, it was effectively eliminated entirely. You heard that right. The net result of changes during that period is that banks are not required to back assets which largely correspond to M3 or broad money with cash reserves. As a consequence, banks can effectively create money without limitation. I know that sounds hard to believe, but let's look at the facts. Imagine if the limit of the amount of money in the banking system was not, as in this example, $125 billion, but was effectively infinite for the same $10 billion on deposit. Further, imagine that this change in banks' ability to create loans coincided with new and exotic forms of money being invented via the securitization of debt and extended to entirely new asset classes and made available to a far larger range of people that previously did not qualify for loans. This essentially describes our system today. If this sounds like a bad idea to you, even if you are not an expert in banking and finance, you can forgive yourself and give yourself a gold star for having a good intuition, because this arrangement is not only bad, it is catastrophically bad. Although reserve requirement ratios haven't been changed since the early 1990s, the level of reserve requirements and required reserve balances has fallen considerably since then because of the widespread implementation of retail sweep programs by depository institutions. Under such a program, a depository institution, like a bank, sweeps amounts above a predetermined level from a depositor's checking account into a special purpose money market deposit account created for the depositor. Most of you will be familiar with this, ladies and gentlemen. Most of your checking accounts have an automatic sweep. And you access interest on the excess money. In this way, the depository institution shifts funds from an account that is subject to reserve requirements to one that is not, and therefore reduces its reserve requirement. With no change in its vault cash holdings, the depository institution can lower its required reserve balance on which it earns no interest and invests the funds formerly held at the Federal Reserve in interest-earning assets. So you see, when banks wanted to expand their lending, they found a technical workaround using these retail sweep programs. How innovative. Apparently the Fed approved of all this too, apparently losing sight of the reason we have reserve ratios in the first place. What was the result of these two changes? The creation of classes of zero and near zero reserve ratio accounts, and the ability of banks to move money from accounts with high reserve requirements to accounts with low or now no reserve requirements at all. A flood of free money. There was then almost no limits to the promissory notes in the form of various securities that could be presented by the banks, with fees of various sorts, interest, originating fees, maintenance fees, penalties, and so on, collected all along the way and booked as profits. This transformation of banking practices seems to have started small but really picked up steam by 1996 and 1997, likely due to competitive pressures among the banks. Those banks that used these methods could easily outcompete those that didn't. Even if some banks avoided these practices for a while because they thought them too risky, eventually they were forced to play along or risk losing business to banks competing for the same borrowers. We've talked about this before. I spent actually a whole show discussing this. Well, again, when I beat up on Alan Greenspan, he is the man responsible for all this. He is the man that could have raised requirements so high that the banks would never have dared place the money in these interest-bearing accounts, because they would have known that at any given moment the Federal Reserve could come in and simply push the ratio up to 100%, meaning that the banks would have no money to give out in terms of customer withdrawals. They would have to liquidate the investments. So they would have been scared into returning to their reserve ratios. But Greenspan went along willingly and perfectly in the knowledge of what was going on. Ladies and gentlemen, don't doubt for one moment. He knew thousands of times better than I know today what was going on, and he knew it as it was happening. Well, all this, you know, certainly goes a long way towards explaining actually a number of observable phenomena, such as soaring M3, the stock market bubble, the real estate bubble, and surprisingly strong banking and financial sector profits, even through a number of severe challenges to the system, such as the Asian financial crisis and 9/11. You know, since about 1995, with these reserve requirements effectively eliminated as a policy lever to control the money supply, and interest rates already high, the Fed found itself unable to exercise any influence over the economy. Recall that the reserve fraction has a direct and outsized impact on the money supply, while short-term interest rates are set by the Fed via open market manipulations, and these only change the money supply at the margins, sufficient only to alter the price of Treasury securities or, equivalently, their yield. This dynamic helps explain why in the last decade some observers have correctly posited that the Fed's control via interest rates has been waning. Thus, Greenspan's preemptively high interest rates had little effect on the money supply and the asset bubble that he likely saw coming his way. Or perhaps, worse than doing nothing, these rate hikes seem to have done the opposite of what he had intended. You know, the specific changes in Fed policy are no less than an abrogation of the Fed's responsibility to manage the money supply of the United States. The Fed's behavior has been a crime visited upon the general citizenry, and the impact of the resulting asset bubbles and inflation will eventually be recognized as harming the most vulnerable, the most severely. And it will be decades before the system returns to normal and business conditions return to the effective confidence level that they enjoyed in the 60s and 70s. Greenspan has crushed this economy, and he has crushed this country. All right, well, I think that we should study a little bit more this issue of deflation. I've mentioned it many times, but you know, we really need to have some kind of an insight into the national consequences of what is quite clearly now a deflationary collapse. People have held out on, you know, waving the inflation flag for as long as possible, but it's becoming harder and harder. And I'm seeing now in the tracts that I read more and more people coming round to admitting, and I don't mean just accepting, but actually admitting that deflation is taking hold over the economy. I now would like to talk a little bit about that. You know, although Bernanke never openly acknowledges it, his great fear is not inflation, it is deflation. And as I've said many times, this is toxic in a debt-driven economy. You know, price stability is a term that increasingly refers to anti-deflationary objectives, to keep prices up rather than down, which is a strange phenomenon, if ever I heard one. What has happened to Japan for the past decade is a terrifying warning to Bernanke. the fundamental problems separating the US and the Japanese economies are structurally different, yet the financial symptoms of economic imbalance are strikingly similar. Japan, with its huge trade surplus denominated mostly in dollars, is the world's greatest creditor nation externally, but the world's greatest debtor nation internally. The US, the world's greatest debtor nation externally, is the world's greatest sovereign creditor through dollar hegemony. What happened to Japan was that even with the world's largest holding of dollar reserve, Japan was unable to ward off a protracted deflationary financial crisis caused structurally by exporting wealth for paper that is useless in Japan. The more dollars Japan earns, the more its domestic sovereign debt expands, along with the expansion of its foreign exchange reserves, causing more severe domestic deflation. For the U.S., even when the Fed can print dollars at will, it would be unable to ward off a debt crisis, because the more dollars the Fed prints, the more seriously it adds to the debt crisis. At some point, even paper debts cannot be repaid by printing more paper due to the exponential ballooning interest rate spiral. Paying interest on unpaid interest will soon accelerate the debt crisis. Debt, if not repaid by gold, must be repaid by work. And the Fed, by printing more paper money, actually destroys what little real productive work still available exists in the U.S. economy today. In fact, the financial services sector, a euphemism for the debt manipulation sector, is producing most of the new jobs in the U.S., and such jobs create financial value by pushing paper around at increasing speed. A look at the Japanese debt economy in the last decade will give some idea of what awaits the U.S. debt economy when deflation hits. The Japanese government is in an inescapable debt spiral by virtue of the fact that nominal GDP is falling at an annual rate of about 5%. Stabilizing the Japanese government's debt-to-GDP ratio would require that nominal GDP rises at a rate equal to the interest rate on its outstanding debt, or about 1%. The fact that nominal GDP is falling at a 5% rate means that Japan's debt-to-GDP ratio will rise at least 6% a year, even without a sudden need to recapitalize insolvent banks. That debt-GDP ratio is now 130%. And at 6% a year, it will double in just over a decade. That fact will itself accelerate the collapse of Japanese government bonds unless deflation is reversed. The current U.S. debt-to-GDP ratio is only 76%, but the trend is not different from the Japanese debt spiral. The Japanese crisis was caused by exports, while the United States crisis is being caused by imports. The Japanese trade surplus, coupled with a capital account deficit, the opposite of the U.S., has been leaking yen into dollars faster than the Bank of Japan, the central bank, can inject more yen into the yen money supply because of the so-called liquidity trap. In fact, the Japanese Treasury has been withdrawing yen from the Japanese money supply by selling Japanese government bonds at a faster rate than the Bank of Japan can inject new yen into the banking system. Similarly, the U.S. trade deficit, coupled with its capital account surplus, has been leaking dollars into the global dollar economy faster than the Fed can inject dollars into the U.S. domestic economy. This has happened because sometime in the last decade, the global dollar economy has outstripped the U.S. domestic economy through globalized trade financed by dollar hegemony as more and more dollars strayed offshore, even if they were owned by U.S. entities rather than foreigners. The notion that a strong dollar is in the U.S. national interest, no matter who owns it, is at best controversial and increasingly foolhardy. It is where the dollars are based that determines if a strong dollar is good for the U.S. national interest. A strong dollar in a global dollar economy is only good for offshore dollar owners, not U.S. residents. Well, all of these different things we've talked about are now growing and conspiring basically as a tremendous weight on the economic system, which is going to floor every aspect of lending come 2009-2010. Now, I've said to you that we're already in a depression, and I don't use those words lightly. But if you will understand, ladies and gentlemen, what I have just read to you, if you can get that the deflationary forces can only bring catastrophe upon this country, then you have to pray that inflation can be managed into the system. And that is partly what this GSE linking to the government and to the Treasury and ultimately to the taxpayer is all about. They are trying to create inflation. They are trying to, as they say, to push on a string. Inflation, as I repeat once more, can only obtain if wages and salaries rise, if business conditions continue to thrive, and if the Federal Reserve can effectively pour more money into the banking system. The banking system are not going to want to take Federal Reserve money if it is only to pay down their off-balance sheet loans. But the off-balance sheet loans have got to come back onto the books because of the law that was passed last year forbidding these loans to stay on the books for much longer. So as these off-balance sheet tricks and loans and shenanigans become repatriated to the balance sheet, all of the bank's liquidity is going to be tied up. Any of the money which comes into the system will be used to pay those off, and there will continue to be no money left over from the everyday man in the street. And this will simply propagate even more deflation, and the dollar will rise even faster. And interest rates will continue to fall. Now, interest rates will rise, perhaps, on the short term. And I say perhaps, because it's not even certain that that will happen. But if they do, they will rise because of lack of confidence in the system. If people have no confidence in the system, what do? In general, they buy U.S. government bonds. So your real problem comes when you see that the price of bonds falls at the same time as everything else falls, which is not because of inflation. It is very simply a function of reduced confidence in the system. And I believe that we need to see that yet to come. You know, all of these financial companies that you see are having difficulties, like Merrill Lynch, all of these companies are having problems now because sovereign wealth funds from Asia and the Middle East and private equity companies have swooped in with capital infusions for many of these big banks during the winter when it appeared that the worst of the housing meltdown was behind the market. But now these bets are underwater. How many of these investors do you think are going to pour new capital into these companies, given the further prospect of troubles with the so-called collateralized debt securities, or the CDOs, which include bundles and bundles of now worthless home loans that were sold off to investors around the globe? You know, nobody knows how much money is tied up in these things. As a professor of finance at Manhattan College, Charles Geist, said, it's impossible to get a handle on the value of these CDOs. And Geist also said that it could take another couple of years before the banks have made enough write-downs. He says, it's amazing when you think about the number of people pumping their chests and saying, the worst of this is over, even as far back as April or May. You know, a month ago, Merrill Lynch raised $8.55 billion, selling new shares for $22.50 each, which was a 60% discount to where its stock was trading at the beginning of the year. You know, when the old CEO of Merrill Lynch had been ousted, the new chief executive, John Thayne, announced huge write-downs. And he kept assuring everybody, time and time again over the last few months, that the bank's troubles were behind it. And then he announced, you know, that Merrill Lynch would sell a huge portfolio of mortgage-related assets for $7 billion, just months after saying that those assets themselves were worth $31 billion. You know, that kind of thing puts pressure on markets all across the board, not least of which the CDOs, which, again, I remind you, ladies and gentlemen, nobody has a clue how much there are out there. And these other banks consequently have less incentive to hang on to the impaired assets in hopes that prices will recover. Kenneth Worthington, who's an analyst with J.P. Morgan, he said, we see this as part of the cleansing process. You know, one of the reasons that large investment banks have gone to sovereign wealth funds is because they're classic long-term buy-and-hold investors. This means they don't get spooked by short-term market volatility. But you can see how hard these institutions of a time they're having in attracting these investors. So not only the banks now have seized up and caused a credit crunch, it's the very people who are responsible for the lifeblood of capitalism, the investors, if they are balking at putting new money into the system, then where's the money going to come from? You know? Well, as we've seen, you and I, ladies and gentlemen, the dumb taxpayers, these are the people who are going to be dinged for the money, either directly or in the form of new loans which are taken out, the basis of which the taxpayer is going to have to pay the interest. It is truly a sad and pathetic state of affairs, but very, very frightening. And you should all be aware, ladies and gentlemen, that this is going to have a very unpleasant and sticky end. All right, this is Richard Martin from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call saying bye-bye for now. I will see you again Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Look forward to it. And until then, bye-bye.